Welcome to Conversation for Exploration. Hi, I'm your host, Laura Lee. Well, we have talked to so many scientists and researchers and other folks who say, you know, Darwin's theory of evolution isn't the only impetus to evolution, to change, to the growth of life forms and patterns. It's not the whole story here. Natural selection, just one of many mechanisms. And so many people have poked some holes into Darwin's theory. And again, it's a theory, the theory of evolution. So why are we in this culture treating it as a fact a bit prematurely here? Well, so if there's more to evolution than Darwinian natural selection, what is it? Where's the spiritual component? Michael Cremo, who gave us earlier Forbidden Archaeology and the Hidden History of the Human Race, and who is a long-time Vedic researcher, has a proposition here pulled straight from the Vedas, and he says, we're more than just matter. We devolved or came down from the realm of pure consciousness or spirit, is the basic premise of his newest book, Human Devolution, a Vedic Alternative to Darwin's Theory. We've had many, many interviews with Michael Cremo over the years. It's always a joy to talk with you, Michael. Welcome back, and how are you?
Oh, I'm fine, Laura Lee. Excuse me.
You know, I'm glad to get the Vedic viewpoint because it's such a fascinating and complete view of the world and goes back, what, at least 5,000 years, if not more?
That's right. The ancient Sanskrit writings go back at least 5,000 years. According to the information contained in the writings themselves, they were first set down in a script about 5,000 years ago, but they represent an oral tradition that goes much further back in time.
And what you guys were proposing, you and your co-author Richard Thompson, were proposing in your earlier books is that modern, anatomically modern human beings go back, oh, millions of years, and you found evidence at least to suggest
yes.
this.
Yes, yeah. That's right. The ancient Sanskrit writings would suggest that humans like ourselves have been present for vast periods of cyclical time on this planet, and the time cycles go back many, many millions of years. And when when Richard Thompson and I did 8 years of research into the whole history of archaeology, we actually found there's quite a bit of evidence to support that. You know, there are just hundreds of human artifacts, human footprints, and human skeletal remains that go back tens of millions, even hundreds of millions of years, but they're not very well known either to scientists or to the public in general because of what we call a process of knowledge filtration.
Which means that which supports the current worldview gets included, talked about in the journals, written up. That which goes outside the current worldview tends to be ignored. But I remember asking you, so if you laid out all of the evidence, what portion of it would be pro, what would be con? You said, well, people think that this stuff is anomalous, there's a piece or two, but you said if you put it all out on the table and you could look at everything all at once, you'd have what percentage that would support the very ancient existence of human beings.
Well, it's hard to put an exact number on it. I mean, we should remember, first of all, that Richard Leakey, one of the proponents of the current theory, said that the really good evidence for the current theory that human beings evolved from apes could be put on a couple of billiard tables.
Yeah.
So, we've definitely got much more than that. We've got a whole billiard hall full of billiard tables of anomalous evidence
yeah.
to support the other idea.
So the knowledge filter at work is not just one piece here or there. So, I would assume that whatever forces are pushing human evolution, pushes life evolution all of a piece. It's not just humans that are devolving, from spiritual super states of consciousness down to matter. I think it's all life, isn't it? Aren't we on the boat with the whole web of life? We're not such special creatures.
Oh, sure. I mean, that's absolutely true as far as I can see. These other creatures, although many people would like to say they're simply automatons, we can see even animals like cats and dogs, they have feelings, they have consciousness.
And
even if you go down to the to the level of the simple one-celled creatures. Many scientists, you know, such as Beverly Rubik, of who used to be with Frontier Sciences organization at University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, she was able to show that even these one-celled creatures are responsive to mental suggestions, that they appear to move in their environments in a purposeful way. So yes, I think we're talking about a web of life that includes all the Earth's creatures.
Well, I would say all the creatures everywhere.
Maybe even beyond that.
It's a cosmic solution here that you're proposing. Okay, what part of Darwinian theory do you agree with, and what parts don't you agree with?
Well, I believe that there is a process of reproduction with modification. That's what Darwin proposed, that living things reproduce, and that in the process of the reproduction, they change in different ways. Now, he believed that the process went from the more simple living things to the more complex living things.
Which is logical.
And, well, and from a certain perspective, I would think. And he also believes it was an entirely material process. In other words, we look at living things as simple machines, and they reproduce, and in the course of that reproduction, they change and become more and more complex. Of course, we see that machines generally don't do that. It requires some sort of intelligence, but you know, to make a more complicated machine. But I would agree with him that something like that is going on, but where I would disagree with him is that it goes from the more, you could say, the more subtle and complex living things to the simpler ones. It's sort of like turning, you know, Darwinism upside down. And also, I've proposed in my book, Human Devolution, that before we even talk about this question, where did the living things come from, or where did human beings come from, we should first of all ask, well, what is a living thing? And most scientists would agree with Darwin that living things are simply combinations of material elements. But I think when we look at all the evidence available to science, it's more reasonable to start with the assumption that a living thing is composed of three things, matter, mind, and consciousness, or spirit.
Body, mind, spirit.
Yeah. And of course, I'm not the first person to say that. I'm not the only person saying that. But what I've tried to do is give people some idea that this is not just some flowery New Age language, but that there's actual scientific evidence to support this. And I think there is quite a bit of evidence like that. So I do believe that there is a process of reproduction with modification that goes on, but it begins at this level of pure consciousness and goes down from there. And it's intelligently guided
The intelligently guided, there's a whole movement that says, okay, it's not creationism, but there's the processes of evolution, and there's some sort of intelligence guidance just to evolution, to our life, individually, collectively, to the whole universe. There is an intelligence, let's call it God for lack of a better word, but there is that guiding principle. That's what a lot of the science-minded types who can't quite cotton to creationism in its pure theory, have concluded. That's what I felt for a long time. Okay, there's some guiding principles here. What's so hard to figure about that?
Yes.
Because modern-day science likes to say, okay, if you can see it, it's real. If you can't see it, it isn't real, and push consciousness just off the table, right?
Well, Lorelei, in one sense, I don't have any objection if someone's a Darwinist and wants to pursue a purely mechanistic explanation for the origin of the bodies of living things without any idea of design, which is what they try to do. They want to explain everything as a series of in a random way, and natural selection chooses among all the random variations, and somehow or other you get more complicated things. Now, if somebody wants to pursue that explanation, I don't have any objection to that. I think it's a valid thing to do. But I would just ask for two things. First of all, that they be honest about the level of explanation they've actually achieved by that method. And really, if you actually look in the scientific literature, they haven't been able to explain how one single complex feature of any organism has arisen by that process.
Well, Michael Behe also looked at Darwin seriously, and I remember him saying, an eye, look at our eyes and how complex and exquisite this machinery is. How you get that from natural selection of random mutations? How do you get from that to this?
Well, that's the problem. Nobody's ever been actually able to spell that out exactly how that occurs. Now, you can say in a general way, well, there must have been some creature that had a light-sensitive spot on its skin, and then that spot folded in on itself, and then a membrane, a transparent membrane, folded over, went over that folded-in spot, sort of making a round ball, and then the inside of that depression became even more sensitive to light, and the muscles began to form around that little lens. You can explain it like that, and it sounds plausible, but if you actually go down to the molecular level, to the genetic level, and say, well, here's the genome of a creature without an eye, and here's the changes in the genes that had to have been made that would have had some effect to make the molecules, the biomolecular structure of that body change in certain ways such that you get a functioning eye, nobody can actually do that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I mean by scientific explanation. I mean, it's all right for the Darwinist to say, well, perhaps it may have happened like that. But when they're not able to actually spell it out in scientific detail on the genetic and molecular, biomolecular level, then we just have to say, well, it's an interesting idea, and good luck.
You spend a lot of time in your book on Alfred Wallace, among others. Marie and Pierre Curie and Oliver Lodge also are in there as scientists who contributed some wonderful ideas that became mainstream ideas, but their paranormal ideas and research and leanings are ignored. The same happened to Isaac Newton, by the way. Nobody talks about his astrological writings. They just go in for the Newtonian physics. So I would like to ask you, because this also gets into the birth of the idea of the theory of evolution, because Wallace was right there, although he's lesser known than Darwin. They both simultaneously came up with the idea. Wallace also felt that there were larger spirit beings, guiding principles, intelligent forces out there that were guiding evolution as well. And could you explain that history to us and how that part of it, which really does coexist nicely with the more mechanical parts of it, this is how these intelligent cosmic forces would work, you know, one of the ways, through evolution, modification, being traits selected for certain changes in the environment, etc. But you can explain this whole history, because it isn't such, they're not mutually exclusive ideas here. Wallace is a good demonstration of that.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Yeah, just a couple of months ago, I was in Moscow. I was on a lecture tour there, and one of the places I spoke was the Darwin Museum in Moscow. And I remember giving my lecture, and at the back of the lecture hall, there were these two huge portrait paintings of Darwin and Wallace. Most people think of the evolution theory as the Darwinian theory of evolution, but for a long time, it was known as the Wallace-Darwin theory of evolution. And what happened, you know, it's an interesting story that you alluded to. I mean, Darwin was sitting in England, and he was writing his book, The Origin of Species, and he'd been working on it for about 20 years, and it seemed to him that it might take another 10 years to finish. But one day, in the mail, he received a package from a young scientist who was working off in Borneo, Alfred Russel Wallace, and the package contained a paper that Wallace wanted Darwin to read. And Darwin read the paper, and he was shocked because the paper spelled out the theory of evolution by natural selection in just the same terms that Darwin was secretly working on himself. And the paper was supposed to be sent to one of the scientific societies in London, where it would be read and published. Now, that shocked Darwin quite a bit, because that would mean, you know, by the laws of scientific etiquette, that the theory of evolution would belong to Wallace.
If he was the first to publish.
Because he'd be the first to publish it. So, you know, Darwin went to some of his scientific friends and said, well, what can I do? And they told him, well, the only thing you could do is get Wallace to agree to have you submit a paper along with his on the same subject and have them both published at the same time.
So now, why would Wallace agree to that anyway?
Well, he was a younger man, and he had he wasn't very well known, and he was an Englishman and well mannered, and he had a great deal of respect for Darwin, who had by that time had some reputation in the scientific world. So he was quite willing to do that.
They weren't going to co-author the paper; they were just going to simultaneously submit papers.
Right. So he agreed to that, mm-hmm. and. Because the papers were about the same topic and they were submitted simultaneously, they both got the credit, you know, for the theory of evolution, and therefore it was called the Wallace-Darwin theory of evolution.
Why did we forget Wallace and just celebrate Darwin then, as later?
Well, that had to do largely, I think, with the fact that later Wallace decided that natural selection was not enough to explain the human brain, which had capacities far beyond any monkey brain or ape brain, and it seemed to be too big of a leap to him to be explained in this way. So he had already, as a young man, been a little bit interested in things like hypnosis and things like that, but the failure of the theory of natural selection to explain the human brain and its level of consciousness led him into psychical research in a big way.
Not cyclical research, this is psychical, like psychic research.
Like paranormal research.
Yeah, okay.
Right. And when Darwin found out about that, he was quite upset. He said, I...
You're dragging this theory into the mud, right?
Yes, he said, he put it in even stronger terms. He says, well, I hope by doing all this, you know, you haven't murdered our joint child, you know, the theory of evolution by natural selection. But Wallace persisted with his research, and he got some very good results, and then he began to publish them and tried to introduce his scientific colleagues to this type of evidence for paranormal powers, for a conscious self that can exist apart from the body. And then he began to make these proposals about how the whole cosmos and the whole process of the formation of living things in the cosmos is governed by higher intelligences, by a hierarchy of higher intelligences. And I think because of this...
They just conveniently dropped him from the
whole...
They
dropped him. Now, you still will read about Wallace and most introductory textbooks about biology, and he will still be given some credit for having...
But you don't hear about his paranormal research in that sense, do you?
That's completely screened out.
He persisted with his research, and he got some good results. What was he doing? How did he, back then, go about testing these ideas? And what did he get?
One way that he did it was by doing laboratory experimental research with mediums. Mediums are, you know, people that have various types of paranormal powers. Some of them are simply mental powers, but others are, you know, there's called what was called the physical phenomenon of mediumship, where mediums had psychokinetic abilities, abilities to make ordinary matter move in ways that we can't explain by our current laws of physics. So Wallace was joined in this research by another prominent English scientist, Sir William Crookes, who was president of the Royal Society, which was England's foremost, you know, topmost scientific society. And, you know, to be a fellow of the Royal Society, I think it's an even more significant honor than getting a Nobel Prize, really. Because each year, dozens of Nobel Prizes are given, but, you know, to be elected a fellow of the Royal Society, that that doesn't happen very often. And he was president. He was later president of this society.
But it shows you how at the turn of the century, these ideas were still in, they weren't quite as dangerous back then, were they? They were
right.
more accepted.
You had
people were more experimental.
Yeah, you had very prominent scientists publicly doing this type of research. Now, the research is still going on today, but you might say at a lower level in terms of the scientific hierarchy.
Yeah.
But at the time, Crookes was certainly at the top of the scientific hierarchy of his day. He had a Nobel Prize in physics. He was president of the Royal Society. And Wallace, of course, was the co-founder of the theory of evolution by natural selection.
So I wish that the scientists of the day that just sort of scathingly say, you're a fool to even contemplate these ideas, I wish they'd remember their predecessors and what they were into, but go ahead.
Right. I think many people, you know, when they hear about paranormal research, they think, oh, no serious scientists would become involved in that. But I think that's because they don't know the real history of science, going back all the way to Newton, as you mentioned, who wrote more about alchemy and astrology than he did about his physics and optics.
Yeah.
But and they were all part of one system, of course.
And they're not looking at the real paranormal questions and inquiry and what they're saying. They're just looking at some kind of fringe.
Yeah, some caricature of it.
Yeah, caricature, thank you.
So, but Wallace and Crookes, they focused a lot of their research on a particular medium, Daniel Dunglass Hume. And he was never detected in any kind of hoax or falsehood or anything like that. So he was, in any area of science, you're going to find cheating. I mean, that's something that we should just put right up there up front. There have been mediums who've done things by trickery, but we see in any science, even today, there are a lot of scientists operating in the biomedical field who fake their research results to get grant money, and it's considered a huge problem. There have been some big articles in the scientific journals about this. So, I mean, I think in any area of science,
any area of any human endeavor, you're going to find some.
But that has to be controlled for, and I think Wallace and Crookes did a very good job of it. For example, they made some experiments, laboratory experiments, with the medium Hume, where they found he was able to, they would set up a balance with a certain amount of weight on it, and he could exert, simply by touching the opposite end of the balance, he could exert huge amounts of force on this balance that simply could not be explained.
Hmm.
On other occasions, he was able to make objects float in the air. On one occasion, they were performing some experiments with, I mean, it sounds strange, but with an accordion. And it seemed that Hume could make this instrument play elaborate tunes simply by holding it with one hand opposite the keys. So to prevent any kind of trickery, they built a cage. The two scientists, they were experimental scientists, so they thought, well, the obvious thing to do is let's build a cage and put the instrument inside this cage. And both of these scientists, the Nobel Prize winning physicist Crookes and the co-founder of the theory of evolution, Wallace, wrote that they saw on several occasions this accordion floating in the middle of the cage, not being touched at all by Hume, and playing elaborate tunes. So you sort of have to ask yourself, well, why would these two prominent scientists write something like that? Why would they write something like that, publish it, distribute it to all their scientific colleagues?
Because that's what they believed they saw.
Well,
would be the logical answer.
Is it because they had some kind of psychological death wish, you know, that they suddenly wanted, you know, their careers to evaporate and have all their colleagues, think they'd gone completely out of their minds, or did they really observe those things? I tend to think it's the latter, that they really observed these things.
You know, you wonder, though, Michael, why aren't there mediums who can do that today when we could television, use TV video and all of this to demonstrate that? I mean, you hear about Uri Geller and his feats in the laboratory, and they're amazing feats. I've seen some of them before in person, but they're not suspending an accordion in air. And then how does somebody do that? Wallace felt, you write, that he felt that there were spirit beings that were able to accomplish these tasks via the medium's help.
Yes, and that there were subtle forces, subtle vital energies, that are connected with human beings, that these mediums can operate through and be controlled through. Higher beings can operate through them. I take these things as evidence that there's what I would call a mind element associated with the human organism, and by that I mean a subtle material energy that can act on ordinary matter in ways that we can't explain by our current laws of physics. Just like air is something invisible and we can't really see it, but we can observe its action. When it blows across some water, it makes waves.
And if we would just open up our understanding of laws of physics, then we would see that this is all through the natural forces of the universe. It's our container of ideas that's too small, not the whole laws of physics out there.
Yes, and in previous times, these types of powers were probably more widespread throughout human society because they were cultivated. Just like people may have some musical talent, but unless it's cultivated, it may not manifest. But these days, scientists are still investigating these psychokinetic phenomena, but they tend to be more focused on what we might call the micro-PK, the micro-psychokinetic events. For example, Robert John and his young colleagues have been working for years with random number generators, and a lot of this work was going on at Princeton University when John was head of the engineering department there. And basically what they would do is sit down, a group of students, in front of these random number generators, and the random number generators, if left on their own, would generate a sequence of zeros and ones. And because it was random, the baseline would be about 50-50. In other words, there'd be just as many zeros as ones, because that's what you'd expect with a truly random number generator. But they would get these students or other subjects to focus their minds on either producing more zeros or more ones, and then they found that the number generators were influenced in a statistically significant way to produce either more zeros or more ones according to the mental intention of the subjects.
So that's a good demonstration that there is some influence from consciousness onto the physical operatings of this world.
Right. And I think that has to be taken into account when we think about human origins, because if we really are made of matter, mind, and consciousness, that sort of suggests that the cosmos itself is divided into regions that are dominated by ordinary matter, regions that are dominated by more subtle energies like mind, and further beyond that, a region of pure consciousness or spirit. And I would say that we begin our existence at that topmost level of pure consciousness, and if we depart from there, if we become attracted to the lower energies, then that original pure consciousness becomes covered by the lower energies of mind and matter and different combinations. According to the different combinations, that's the type of body that we have. But this process can ultimately be reversed. There's a process of devolution, whereby consciousness becomes covered by these lower energies. But I believe there's also a process of re-evolution, whereby consciousness can become freed of those coverings. And that should be the actual purpose of human existence now, because we're living in a world where we have a scientific picture that's based simply on matter. We're really focused on matter, developing, exploiting, the material resources to the maximum extent possible, which is to be expected if that's the type
of worldview. We've asked you the question. So in the Vedas, when they talk about the Sattva Yuga and the Kali Yuga and everything in between, where are we now? And you say, according to a lot of the researchers of the Vedas, we're right heading into the Kali Yuga, the Dark Age, and that's where we look to science, materialism, violence, characterize our age, technology. Well,
yes, that's
what
they
predicted long ago. So it would seem like the scientific attitude, rather than lifting us out of the mire, would be part of would be what you would expect while we're in the Dark Age, because we would be so caught up in materialism, we would forget that we're made of consciousness, that this is our origin point, and this is what we're striving for. That would be characteristic of a Dark Age.
Yes, you're absolutely right about that. But even if it is a Dark Age, that doesn't stop us from lighting a candle, so to speak, each one of us. And just because it's going to rain outside doesn't mean we have to get wet.
That sort of means that's the background in which you operate. Where you go is up to you.
That's right.
Yeah. That's the good news. So go ahead. Tell us more.
Well, I really liked Wallace. I think Wallace was one of the inspirations for my work in writing this book, Human Devolution, because I thought he was such a fascinating personality.
Tell us the rest of the story. What happened to him after evolution and after his psychical research? And he probably thought...
Well, he was genuinely surprised by the reactions that he got from his scientific colleagues, because he had expected them to actually pay attention. He was genuinely surprised when he would invite some of the leading physicists or chemist or biologist of his day to come to a seance, for example, or come to the laboratory to participate in these experiments, and they would simply refuse. They would simply refuse to come and see the evidence. So he was rather genuinely surprised about that attitude from some of his
psychology. What is the deep psychology that prevents people from at least testing the waters, at least looking at the evidence, at least contemplating that there may be higher forces guiding humanity? Because to me, that's a happy story. Thank God there's somebody out there looking after us. Thank God we have some help out there, is my opinion. But,
the psychology behind that is that many of these people believe that they are the higher force that's guiding humanity, and they're not willing to accept that there might be some...
And yet they go to church and they pray to a God that should be, that they say, is that guiding force and the principle. Wouldn't they want to see that there's evidence that God or these higher forces, however you want to characterize them, call them, pay homage to them, would be out there?
Well, it's interesting. There are many scientists who believe in God. Historically, most of the scientists who made the very important discoveries in science, going back to Newton and beyond, they've been believers in God. But more recently, I think that's changed, somewhat. Or at least the conception of God has changed.
How so, do you think?
Well, I think there used to be, if we go back in time, there was, say, a greater willingness among scientists to accept that God had some direct role to play in physical reality. That, there are things that God has some explanatory role to play in the world that we see around us. Whereas the more recent view of scientists who accept the existence of God is that, God is off in his universe some way way beyond us, and he doesn't have anything to do, really, with what goes on in the world.
It was enough that he created the world and then he split and left us on our own?
Left it like a ticking bomb just go on its own. So that's one thing that's come to happen. And I think another thing is that the higher you go up in the hierarchy of science, the less likely scientists are to believe in God.
Really?
Now, this I think this is, I mean, a survey was done, and I, you know, cite this survey of Human Devolution, my new book, that it was done among scientists in America that looked at, say, the average university professor, you know, of science, and it found, okay, maybe about 70% of them believe in God. Then they looked at heads of departments in universities, and the percentage went down to about 50%. And then they looked at the scientists who headed different sections of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. And there the percentage, you know, went down to, you know, around, you know, 20% or something. So it seems that the higher you go up in the hierarchy, the less likely you are as a scientist to believe in God or accept some role for God in the physical affairs of the world, the physical reality of the world.
How interesting. I wonder if all those God-fearing citizens of our country, if they would be alarmed to discover that the movers and shakers in science were a bunch of atheists.
Well, I mean, this is, of course, in America, we're a unique country, really, and you might say the developed world, because according to Gallup surveys and other surveys, about 90% of the American people accept, you know, the existence of God in some way or another. And but if you go to other countries, say Western Europe, you know, the the percentage that accept God and believe in God goes down to around 20%, you know, in the Northern European countries.
I didn't
know
that.
So in that sense, America's very much like a third world country, you know, if you want to look at it that way. But it's still interesting. The about 60%, between 50 and 60% of the American people believe that God created human beings pretty much in their present form. About 20% believe that God created human beings, but he did it by the Darwinian theory of evolution. And this is an idea sort of like Wallace's idea, that you have some intelligent being guiding the process. And only about 10% of the people actually accept the Darwinian theory as it's taught, you know, by scientists in the schools as a purely random process, you know, governed by natural selection alone.
I just find it fascinating how a society can pay lip service to one idea, but when it push comes to shove, they'll go with some other idea. You know, that it's, that there's this hypocritical stance that we take in our lives and our doings. And
well, I think it is a particular type.
Well, there's
of,
at least a disconnect.
I think you're right about that, Laura Lee. You know, it's interesting that I think one of the reasons that it is like that is that the Darwinist element of the scientific community has more or less got a monopoly on the education system.
Okay.
Because by law, they're more or less, you know, they have a monopoly. You can't teach any other idea. And anytime
and they made it legal.
In a group of people, because there are people who don't like this, but when they try to change it, the scientists go to the federal courts, and the federal courts have always decided every single time that when any particular state, you know, tries to allow some version of intelligent design or creationism to be taught in the schools, the federal courts always say, well, this violates separation of church and state or something like that.
And, oh, they vote that, yeah.
And even though the proposals make no mention of God or any particular religion, they simply say, well, we understand what's behind it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's an interesting phenomenon that here in America, we're generally, we don't tolerate the government telling us, you know, you can only listen to one radio station or you can only buy one kind of car. Somehow or other, we are tolerating the government telling us, well, your kids can only learn one idea at school.
Well,
so I was in Russia recently, And I mentioned this in an interview on a Russian television station, and the interviewer told me, he said, well, it's interesting that you're saying that about America, because, you know, he had been interviewing an official from the Moscow school district just before I had come on, and she had said that the policy in Russia is that they mention alternatives in the education system. They say, okay, most scientists today now accept the Darwinian theory of evolution, and here's what they think, but there are others who don't accept it, and here's what they think.
And that's only an honest statement of the facts.
And I think
that it's
be,
not a monopoly, that
right.
There's a lot of controversy and a lot of exploration going on, a lot of dissent within the sciences. That makes it more interesting and exciting.
Well,
it gives us lots to talk about, too, because we like to talk to those alternatives. Now, I found it interesting, Michael, also, that when Mysterious Origins of Man, which mentioned your first book, The Forbidden Archaeology and Hidden History of the Human Race, when that was aired, as a special on NBC, that a bunch of scientists felt so threatened by it that they lobbied the FCC to censor that airing and to fine NBC for airing it. This is what's reported.
Well, yeah, that's absolutely true. It
now,
was
the FCC can, A, censor based on ideas, scientific ideas and their controversial ideas. They can actually step in and say, oh no, to a television network, you can't air this. This is too controversial an idea. And they can actually levy fines.
Well, that's what these scientists want to do. Now I'm happy to say
I'm not saying the FCC would do it, but the fact that they could do it and that they were lobbied to do it, I just find just outrageous.
Oh, I do too. Actually, they wanted the FCC to force NBC to broadcast primetime apologies to the American people. They wanted them to, they said what they should do, be forced to do, is to show the show again, but first have a quote, real scientist introduce the program and tell people it's all nonsense, and then show it.
I thought it was just back in the 50s with Velikovsky that they were able to stop publication of his books. I mean, I didn't really know that kind of censorship went on today just for ideas.
Well,
this isn't, you know, artwork that's offending some people. This isn't, you know, the seven words or whatever. I mean, this is ideas.
Yes, and I think that, I mean, frankly speaking, I mean, the Darwinist scientists have no problem at all getting on television. They could have simply
make their own special.
They could have made their own special, which they do all the time. I mean, you can't turn on.
Go through the Learning Channel.
Yeah, go to. And the Learning Channel or Discovery Channel without seeing one of their programs. But I think what they were really concerned about was their monopoly on the education system. The fact that, you know, they're telling, you know, children one thing at school and the children are only getting their idea. So the fact that one of those children could go home on a Sunday night at 8 o'clock and turn on the television and hear, you know, coming from NBC, you know, information that contradicted what they were told in school. That was just upsetting to them, totally upsetting. And as I said, my personal feeling is I have no objection if someone's a Darwinist, but they just should not try to artificially suppress other voices.
You know, that is interesting. Yeah, let's have a whole, this is a marketplace of ideas. This is America. We fought for freedom of religion. Why can't we fight for freedom of ideas?
Well, what I think in the school system they should do, because that, the schools are supported by public tax money, and most of the people don't accept that theory, so I think they have a voice. Their voice should be respected.
Now, isn't that
interesting? Schools, they should really just say, present the real fact. Most scientists today accept the theory of evolution, and here's their idea. Some scientists don't accept the theory. Here's their ideas, and you kids think about it and make up your own minds.
Well, why is it just left to the scientists? What about the rest of us? And it's interesting that the majority of people still believe that our whole lives and whole existence is guided by higher intelligent forces, call it God, whatever you will, and that all the education and evolution hasn't swayed us from this idea.
Well, Laura Lee, I think one problem is that somehow or other, scientists as a class have escaped to a large extent the skepticism that we extend towards other influential personalities and groups in society. In other words, we don't even accept if the President of the United States says something, then reporters and the general public, they're quite willing to question it, say, well, he doesn't know what he's talking about. Or if a president of a corporation comes up and says something, people will question it.
A scientist does it, and we go, oh, it must be true.
It must be true. Somehow or other, they've managed to escape.
What a PR job the whole science has done on us and our minds.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and maybe that's one reason why they like to present, scientists like to present science as a monopoly. Because then it's like doctors, you think they're God, right? You think that they must know what they're talking about. Whereas if you saw the controversy and the dissent and the questions behind it, you would think, okay, it's all open for question. Really, and
right.
It is.
Well, they like
nothing set in stone here.
They like to let a little bit of controversy in.
Give
but just within
headlines.
Certain limits, sort of like what I call rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic, so to speak. But you can't do... But if you radically contradict, then that's...
Watch out.
That's, and especially if you bring in any type of idea of intelligent design or God or soul or anything like that, then you really begin to experience what I call this knowledge filtering process. It goes into high gear at that point.
So you believe, though, that we are intelligently designed, and that we have devolved from a higher state, and that in those periods that you mentioned, of the millions of years that human beings have existed on this planet, so goes the thought here, that it's a roller coaster ride. We've been up, we've been down. Wherever we are now, that we have a higher expression and we have a lower expression to our potential, to who we are. And that the difference is, how each individual chooses to live its life, a cultural idea, this
ego
and everything in between, or how does it work?
Well, I think it goes beyond more than each individual, because the ideas of the individuals are to a large extent formed by the education they received and by the information.
You are a product of your environment, aren't you?
The information that we receive from the so-called respected authorities, and basically... For the past 150 years or so, the goals that we set for ourselves are determined by the answers to these questions that we continually pose to ourselves. Who am I and where did I come from? And the answers we've been getting from today's scientists, who are like the priest, you could say, of the whole modern society, are that we're simply another type of animal, and we're simply a combination of material elements. And that's really all there is to it. So most people are influenced by that, will consciously or unconsciously, to devote most of their energies to simply producing and consuming more and more material things. I think that it's not an accident that our whole worldwide society has become quite materialistic in its objectives and goals. And it all starts... from the answers to those fundamental questions, who am I and where did I come from? Now, if the answers to those fundamental questions are, we are, spirits in the material world, as the Police once sang in one of their songs, if we are conscious beings, if that's what our real essence is, that means that most of our energy should be put into developing the conscious resources of each individual and of human society in general. And that might mean putting more energy into, what people have traditionally done, down through the ages, is involve themselves in some kind of practice of meditation or prayer or yoga or whatever, to develop those conscious resources, to develop those spiritual resources with... That this doesn't mean neglecting the material side of life, but it's a question of perhaps restoring some balance.
Yeah.
And I think the balance has gone way off onto the material side of things, to the neglect of these.
And so part of it is the story that we have been told about who we are and what is our purpose here.
That's
and
right.
And where are we in the grand context of things? What is the universe in the grand context of things? And part of it is that this very story and the protection of that story is what keeps us all in place, to be good worker bees and consumer bees and keep the whole society going on this rampant rampage through natural resources and destabilizing a sustainable future.
Oh, yeah. Well, we
got to tell ourselves the story in order to keep doing what we're doing. Change the story, we change our activities.
You've hit it right on the head, Laura Lee.
So there are vested interests.
I could have said it better myself.
There are vested interests in keeping us believing as we are, therefore doing as we are, therefore allowing them to be at the top of their little heap. You know, the status quo enjoys that we go. They've struggled long and hard to get to the top of the heap, and they don't want the rest of us waking up and going, gee, maybe we don't have to play this script. Maybe this is the story of our lives. Maybe there's something else we could do with our potential and our future and our resources and our earth and humanity as a whole. That could be very dangerous to them, but very liberating for the rest of us.
I think we've seen, I mean, just to put it on a very practical level, we see that, say, right after 9/11, when people were very frightened and they had stopped flying and stopped going out of their homes, you know, the economy dipped. You know, the gross national product or the rate of expansion of the economy dipped by just 1 or 2 percentage points, and that had huge effects on the whole worldwide network, you know, political, economic, scientific network that is invested in ever-increasing material production. Just a very slight decrease in that had huge shock waves, so that, you know, we had, you know, the president coming out and telling us not to, you know, cut back on, you know, production or consumption, but to, you know, just keep living, keep spending.
Oh, and therefore they were justified to keep spending to keep us safe so this wouldn't happen again.
Yeah,
you know, open your checkbooks. Let's go.
I just want to say that in support of your idea that there are people who have a big interest in seeing that, you know, people keep focused on this goal of, you know, consuming and producing more and more material things, because if that stops or if it even decreases by a small percentage point, it has huge effects on people who have an interest in keeping that system going.
What if we all woke up one day, Michael? What if we just all woke up and said, you know what? We don't need to engage in this rat race. You know, our whole infrastructure has been dissolved beneath us. A, we don't know how to live any other way. We are truly dependent on this system. Not that we have to be, just that we've forgotten the old ways. We've forgotten how to exist without this whole Western civilization infrastructure. I mean, you know, we're all caught up in this, whether we want to or not.
Yes, I wouldn't even call it Western, because if you go back far enough in Western history, there was an economy that was based on different principles and a way of life that was based on, you know, different principles, more consciousness-friendly principles. But so whether we're talking East or West, I mean, I think it's just a question of balance. Again, you know, I wouldn't want, you know, people to think that the result of, you know, changing things would be that we'd all go back to the Stone Ages and, you know, be living terrible lives. But I think there is a question of balance that needs to be addressed. And basically, I mean, people who have looked into this problem of how to reverse, you know, the damage that we're doing to the environment by our activities have concluded that really the only, you know, that's a spiritual solution that needs a spiritual problem that needs a spiritual solution. And even the World Watch Institute, which is one of the biggest organizations that's looking into these problems, has concluded the way it's going to change is by small groups of people just adopting a life of voluntary simplicity, you know, just living a little lower, you could say, on the food chain, so to speak.
On the material food chain, but you're living higher on your own soul's satisfaction and spiritual chain.
Yeah, in other words, you might say simpler living, higher thinking, you know, if you want to put it that way.
Okay. Personal choice, where you want to be on that equation.
Well, yes, I think we're all making those choices. And I think many people are, as you are, and I think I am, and others, making that decision to focus more on the cultivation of consciousness and live a little more simply, not talking about giving up everything, but living a little more simply and putting more energy into things that really matter.
So why'd you call your book Human Devolution?
Well, I called it that to encapsulate the idea that we did not evolve up from matter, as most scientists now tell us, but that we have devolved or come down from consciousness or spirit. And I thought that was just the simplest way to get across, you know, that idea. When I say devolution, I mean that we originally existed on a level of pure consciousness, and that when we depart from that level of pure consciousness, when we become attracted to the lower energies, we become covered by them, we become conditioned by them. But it's a process that we can reverse. And there are so many ways to do that. Every spiritual tradition in the world has some method of prayer or meditation or yoga to accomplish what I call, you know, a re-evolution of the human spirit.
Which is why those wisdom traditions have been around for so long. So what are the characteristics of being caught in the lower?
Well, I think we can all feel that. We're more or less driven, sometimes it seems even against our own better impulses, to simply become involved in the consumption, you know, increasing consumption and production of more and more material things. I think intelligent people today, what do they do if they want to get ahead? Well, they go to school and they try to get a job in some company that's economically successful in producing something. In other words, of digging resources out of the ground and putting them together in a way that can be mass marketed to the public around the world. But I mean, is that something that can go on forever? You know, I think we have to ask about that. What if everyone in the world, all the 6 billion people in the world, were consuming as many material resources as the average, you know, American or European is consuming today?
We'd hit that brick wall even faster.
Yes. So, I mean, at a certain point, this is going to have to stop, you know.
That's my question. What if we all woke up? What's the alternative besides just going back to the Stone Age?
Well, you know, yeah, it's interesting. I've been to some very interesting places. For example, when I was last in Europe, I visited a community of people from some of my co-religionists. As many of your listeners probably know, I've, you know, been involved in the Krishna consciousness movement for some time. And there's a community in Hungary where they have about 100 families living on a beautiful piece of land, off in the mountains of the southwestern part of the country, where they're completely off the power grid, but they have beautiful homes, you know, powered by, you know, solar power, some wind power, you know, generated by the wind, and then some power that's got from sustainably harvested wood from a plot of forest land that they own. And basically they're growing all of their own foods, but it's not a subsistence economy. They have a beautiful cultural life there, with full of arts and music and study and meditation and yoga. And it's just a very, very beautiful place where you have plants, animals, and humans, and mm-hmm. just living in a very harmonious way, not harming anyone. It's just very wonderful. Now, I live in the middle of Los Angeles. That's where you could say fate has put me now. But still, I think I try to create my own little bubble of consciousness.
You know what's interesting is that the other idea that has been sold to us is that we need technology in order to live comfortably and to live, I don't know, luxuriously. And we need modern technology and this progress of more and more and more and more and more resources to abuse and spit out. And, you know, look at ancient societies. Some of them live beautifully material lives, sustainably, beautiful cultural lives, beautiful spiritual lives where they were in balance, and all of this. It can be done again. It's like, you're right, we just need a spirituality back into the equation to guide our activities where we can have it all. I believe we can have it all.
Well, I think you're right about that, and I think how it will start is with small groups of people, just gradually adopting these kinds of ideas and principles and putting them into practice in their own lives. And then
saying, A, it can work, and B, this is how you do it, and C, you can do it too. It can spread. It can be an idea that will spread like, well, we'll have to do it sooner or later, Michael, because the way that we're doing things can only go, can take us so far. You can only ride a horse into the desert so far, and then you've got to get down and do something else.
Hopefully, you know, people will realize that. I mean, when I say, I mean, individually, many people are already understanding these things, and they're forming their own communities, or they're working within a larger society to further these goals, and I think that's good. But let's hope that you could say the mass of people come to this understanding, you know, before
they're forced to.
Yeah, before they're
it's nice to do it voluntarily.
On a horse in the middle of the desert with the last drop of water. Yes.
Yeah. Michael, thank you so much. I look forward to talking with you further. There's a lot of very interesting ideas and research that you've done in your newest book, Human Devolution, A Vedic Alternative to Darwin's Theory. So we'll hear more from Michael Cremo. And thank you for listening. Good luck on your journey, wherever it takes you. I'm Maura Lee.
Maura Lee Online. www.mauralee.com.
As you enjoy the guests, topics, discussions here on The Laura Lee Show,